The swelling chorus of Thelma Houston's Don't Leave Me This Way is pulsing out of giant speakers ringing the dance floor of a steamy discotheque in Quebec City. I am hustling with Margaret, her blazing eyes and open-mouthed smiles spinning around my ears as I lead her in our most complex spins and twirls. The triple fake, the behind-the-neck switcheroo, the walking turn.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulabin. Carl Capitorto grew up in the Bronx. He writes about his childhood in the 1960s and 70s in his new book. It's called Twisted Head, an Italian-American memoir. Capitorto actually means twisted head in Italian, as in head of state. And Carl Capitorto says his father did his best to live up to the name. Now, you might recognize Capitorto if you saw him. He played little Polly in HBO's The Sopranos. And he's been in a lot of movies with actor John Turturro, who introduces him at this reading, recorded in November 2008 at the McNally Robinson Bookstore in New York City.
Thank you. Well, I'm a bookstore junkie, so this is a really nice bookstore, isn't it? I know Carl. I guess I met Carl. My wife, Catherine Borowitz, met Carl at the O'Neill when he was a playwright. He was chosen to be one of the playwrights, I think, in 1985. And we've worked together on a few films. Carl directed me in a short film that he did many years ago, and we were both in Five Corners in 1986, and I directed Carl in Mac, which he helped me develop, which was my first film I directed as a director. So we've known each other for a long time, and I'm really happy to introduce him tonight. This is a book that I read. I was either laughing when I read the book, or crying, or remembering. But you know, in our culture, it's told in a very specific way. But the culture that we come from, there aren't that many books about our past or the people who came here. And I think many of the people who came to the country were not that educated because they were the poor people. And so books were not thought of as something to bring with you or to have in your house. And we're really from that culture. And the people who took a step forward into literature, it was a big step for many people to take. And you don't really see, we don't have many writers writing about that particular experience. Though it is a very universal one as far as, you know, immigrants go and having people come here and define themselves, their identity through work or what they stand for or how their family functions. So it's something that there's just been a tremendous lack of. And when I read the book, I just couldn't believe how many things came, you know, flooding back to me, and things that I didn't know too. And obviously there were things that I just discovered about Carl's world and where he grew up. But I think it's a wonderful book, and you know, it would be a great Christmas present too. But really, I really, really love the book. I'm not here if, even though Carl is my friend, if I didn't like the book, I wouldn't be here. But I, you know, he's always been a terrific writer, and he started out, I think, really as a playwright, and he's someone I hope to work with again. But I really, you know, I highly recommend the book. But I also think it's a window into a world that people don't know. They know very, very little about all the wonderful things and all the crazy things that constitute growing up within this culture. So. It's my pleasure to introduce Carl Capitorto.
How are you? Thanks. And so I know a lot of you, but then there are people I don't know. That encourages me. How are you? Thank you, John. That was really sweet. You know, we've known each other a long time. And back when we first met, John introduced me to a friend of his that he had just met at that time. They were working together on a movie called The Fortunate Pilgrim with Sophia Loren, based on a book by Mario Puzo. And I was thinking on my way here tonight, well, okay, John and this person I'm about to introduce to you now, you know, are associated in my mind with The Fortunate Pilgrim. And then I feel very flattered. Now I'm embarrassed because I thought it would be a smaller crowd, but this is what I planned to say, so I'm going to say it, is that I was really delighted and flattered that Ken Auletta wrote a quote for this book, and in it he makes a reference to Mario Puzo's The Fortunate Pilgrim, which was enormously flattering to me. And I was thinking about this on the way here, and so I don't know, you do with that what you will, but there's some kind of confluence between Totoro, the person I'm about to bring up, Mario Puzo, and me. I don't know. You decide. The person that I'm referring to is so, I'm so grateful to both John and her for coming. So without any further delay here, let me introduce you to Annabella Sciorra. You're okay with that?
Yeah, sure.
We're working this out on our feet. You're all right with this?
Yeah, I need a little help introducing us. Yeah.
So here's Annabella. And we thought it would be fun if she read a few pages that I select for her, and then I'm going to read a few pages that she selected for me. So that's what we're going to do. So I've asked her to read from chapter 16, just because I thought it would be a fun passage to hear in her voice. This is pretty late in the book, right? Because it's like page whatever that is, 257. So before this, there are 256 pages. So am I right?
You're absolutely right.
So math has never been my strong point. So there's a lot of story, in other words, before this, and I cannot possibly recap it for you. So you're on your own. But I will say that that it's late in the book. The book starts like in the 60s, and I'm a kid, and the family is young, and my father has a pizza shop, and it's all kind of madness, the 60s. Okay, and then it goes forward. And then eventually it becomes the second half of the book, and it's the 70s. And it's like I'm discovering disco, and I'm discovering myself a little bit, and as my father pulls us into another mad endeavor, which I won't tell you about, you can read it. And so now I'm getting ready, I'm maybe 17 years old or something, and I'm getting ready to go away to college. And it's around this point that Annabella picks up and reads this section. You know what, though? There's a reference. Oh, that's a CD that I was looking for. So I should just tell you that, because there's this reference that will make more sense if you know that a little earlier in the book, two of my my close friends that I grew up with were killed by the Son of Sam. They were some of his earliest victims. No, sweetie, don't bend. Thank you. And there's a slight reference to it. Anyway, take it away, Annabelle.
I'm so glad you did that.
Okay.
Want to do the hills? Moonface Marina Alyati asks devilishly from behind the wheel of her 76 Ford Mustang, electric blue with black hardtop and white leather interior. Hell yeah, we respond. It's a ritual. Now she drives to the top of a long avenue, I forget which, maybe Mace or Waring, way up past St. Lucie's, and then pedal to the metal, tears at top speed down 12 blocks or more, the car dipping and bouncing over several steep hills along the way. We scream as if we were aboard the Dragon Coaster at Rye Playland. Marina providing a live operatic soundtrack at the top of her lungs. She loves to sing. An old buddy of mine from day camp and CYO and a childhood friend of Donna's and Valentina's, Marina had by then become one of my favorite people in the world. She, Peter, and I formed a frequent threesome. Zoftig, with inky black bone straight hair, wide dark eyes, and sweet funny features reminiscent of a young meteor Kay Ballard. Marina was a natural mimic and comedian, regularly sending our crowd into dangerous convulsions of laughter. We'd beg her to stop, fearing for our lives, but she was relentless. Marina killed, trading in high camp long before any of us even knew what that meant. Her best friend from St. Catherine's Academy for Girls, Joanne Puglia, a compact, oversexed little vixen with a part-time job at a bread shop on a sleepy stretch of Morris Avenue Park, where she was known to hang the closed sign on the door from time to time to make it in the basement with a delivery man, was consistently trying to mount and mate me in the back seat of the car. I'm so fucking horny, I could fucking fuck that fucking fire hydrant right now, was a typical declaration. In fact, you know what? Pull over. She'd hop out and straddle the nearest Johnny pump, bounce up and down a little, and then hop back into the car and start yanking up my pants, shoving a tongue down my throat. Drive out to Orchard Beach parking lot, she'd pant at the driver's seat, and don't look back. No, Marina, don't do it, I'd squeal, peeling Joanne's fingers off my zipper. Joanne, cut it out. You're like my sister. I can't do it with you. I'd usually clamber up to the relative safety of the passenger seat, leaving Joanne to writhe and moan alone. Hey, hey, don't stain my leather back there, Marina would bark. Fucking nympho. She claimed most of the Catholic high school girls were like this. Oh, yeah, she'd say. Oh, you didn't know? They're a bunch of hooas. Marina displayed the makings of a young Anna Magnani in her performance as the maid in the CYO production of A Day in the Life of Archie Andrews, in which I was cast as Reggie Mantle and recruited line for a cameo as the Andrews' family dog. The audience roared as my divinely silly friend prattled on in an outrageous accent she'd invented for the character, slipping trippingly from Irish to Swedish to Cockney to Russian to Italian and then back again. She even managed from out of nowhere to work in her pirate impression, her favorite bit from some old movie. So you say you wanna take a walk, eh? Well, tomorrow morning at sunrise, you'll walk the plank, eh? Something like that, right? Stopping the show more than once with her over-the-top physical antics, Marina raised the bar she herself had set a season or two earlier at the annual CYO talent pageant with her audacious rendition of I've Got a Lovely Bunch of Coconuts, performed in a homemade Carmen Miranda costume while juggling a pair of hairy brown coconuts and belting out the lyrics in a ridiculously broad Cockney accent. I've got a lovely bunch of coconuts, and they are all standing in a row. Her parents, mid-century immigrants from Abruzzi, were laborers. Her father, a groundkeeper at a Westchester County office park. Her mother, an office maintenance worker on the midnight shift. The living room of their attached brick house on Paulding Avenue was cordoned off by a velvet rope, beyond which loomed dreamily a green and gold velvet couch, encased in plastic slipcovers, a smoky glass kidney-shaped two-tiered coffee table, a glass and brass curio cabinet displaying delicate porcelain figurines, and several large pieces of Romanesque statuary, including a painted lady holding a huge bunch of grapes that lit up when you plugged them in. All sat neatly upon a spotless carpet of bright fuchsia. Marina's bedroom was a vision in pink and white, with a ruffled canopy crowning her queen-size bed. Mr. and Mrs. Aliotti showered their American-born daughter with more luxury than they could afford. She was their princess, ambassador, spokeswoman, translator, business manager. Their eyes and ears in a world that they found endlessly baffling. She had an older brother living in San Francisco with whom the family appeared to have little contact. So she was, for all intents and purposes, a pampered only child accustomed to getting what she wanted. Give me that, she said when I showed her my copy of Hotline, The Letters I Get and Write by Burt Reynolds, a paperback I'd found in the book rack at Royal Stationery on White Plains Road, featuring steamy fan mail allegedly received by Dreamy Burt and his equally steamy alleged responses, along with several pages of semi-nude photos. Marina snatched the book from my hands and buried it in her underwear drawer. I never saw it again. She was sullen and depressed for weeks and months after the double murder. We all were. The killer was out there, killing still. Some neighborhood boys formed a posse and vowed to hunt the fucking psycho down and string him up from a fucking lamppost by his fucking balls. It was an empty pose. Whenever we managed to forget for a while and found ourselves laughing at some silly thing or another, one of us would express guilt and shame for enjoying ourselves while our pals lay cold and rotting in their graves. We dragged ourselves to the CYO spring dance, moping around on the sidelines. Not at all our usual selves. Finally, we gathered in a cluster to do a simple pony, our old standby before the standard dance of our pre-disco youth. Irene Murphy shook her huge rack while performing the little hop step. "Cut that out," her stoner boyfriend, unseen, bellowed from a dark corner. I was just starting to feel the music when a handsome thug approached me menacingly, his boys in tow. It was Fernando, my junior high school nemesis, not a regular here. I couldn't tell if he recognized me or thought I was fresh meat. "We don't like the way you dance," he said. "So what?" I responded, sounding in my own ears like a girl. "You dance like a fag," continued. "Too bad," I shot back lamely. He stamped on my foot, punched me hard in the stomach, and stalked out of the gymnasium. Humiliated, I left the party. My sympathetic friends and I headed over to White Castle to smother our sorrows in tiny steamed cheeseburgers, shoestring fries, and vanilla milkshakes. Stephen Patrick, the musical genius of our crew, a fair, fey wisp of a boy with a hushed speaking voice and fine hands, had recently been hired as the church organist, and he had his own key. We snuck into St. Lucie's on a regular late-night basis, getting high and gathering around the organ to hear Stephen perform "Love Lies Bleeding," including the long extended intro and other selections from Elton John's "Goodbye Yellow Brick Road." The windy strains of the old Hammond, pumped out hard by a driven young player, echoed off the plaster walls and marble surfaces of the empty church. We usually ended up wandering alone in different directions, each taken by the experience in our own way, achieving something like spiritual fulfillment in that room for the first time. I experienced a brief calling to join the priesthood. A life in God seemed both a ready solution to the problem of my sexuality and a chance to inhabit a permanently enhanced, heightened state of consciousness, akin perhaps to being high all the time. The heavenly summons came during a CYO retreat at a dude ranch in upstate New York, where trained counselors and young priests led us through a weekend of spiritual exercises, meditation, and prayer. At one point, well greased for it, we were invited to lounge on the carpeted floor of a large studio and listen to a recording of "Everything I Own" by Bread. "I give up my life, my heart, my home. I would give everything I own just to have you once again, just to touch you once again." We were encouraged to cry and to just let it out about nothing in particular, about everything, anything. Our sins, perhaps, our fear of God, our unworthiness, and to then stream up to a podium where several young priests sat ready to hear our confessions. This solemn sacrament was usually performed in the absolute privacy of a darkened booth. The theatrical public arrangement in the room was intended, I guess, to create a kind of fever of penitence. It worked. My friends and I became undone by this exercise, sobbing deeply, rising to our feet, and stumbling up to the podium one by one. I remember sitting before an earnest cleric, his head bowed and his hands folded, unable to do anything but weep. I wanted to tell him that I was overwrought with anxiety, that I found the world around me terrifying and wild and couldn't see my place in it, that my own body and mind had become foreign territory, daily doing battle with me. And I was prepared and willing to turn to God and devote myself to him with all my heart, to throw myself at his mercy and put myself completely into his hands if it would mean deliverance. I wanted to say all this and more, but all that came out was woo-hoo! Finally, the priest spoke in a cold voice. What are you crying about?" I dried up instantly. "I'm not sure," I said. The moment was gone, evaporated. I confessed a few sins and did my penance and returned to the group. And by the time we were on the bus back to the Bronx, my celestial caller had hung up the line. The trip home was a mess. Those foolish priests had led us deep into the forest of ourselves and abandoned us there. Most of my friends, tear-streaked, looked wounded and lost, especially Billy. He'd been a fellow altar boy, the kid originally responsible for introducing me to all the others and my most treasured friend when we were younger. Billy had a profound and completely distracting long-term crush on a handsome young boy named Adriano. He confessed his forbidden love to a priest during the Everything I Own exercise, rocking back and forth afterwards, sobbing the words, "I don't want to be this. I don't want to be this. I don't want to be this." The poor kid never recovered, his slender little frame quivering in the arms of one female friend after another the whole way home. Days later, he denied it ever happened. "What? No. I was just upset because JoJo was sick and we might have to put her to sleep." Somehow, we were supposed to believe, and pretended we did, that the phrase, "I don't want to be this," had something to do with an ailing chihuahua.
Annabella Sciorra, ladies and gentlemen, my old pal. Thank you for doing that. That was fun to hear. I've never heard anybody... Hi, John. I've never heard anybody read this material before. That was really fun. It's a little out of context for you, but, you know, you grab what you can. I was going to read a couple of pages, but then, I don't know if I still have you think. I'm just, like, really short, because Annabella asked... Again, I mentioned to you that we traded pages that we thought would be fun for to hear from each other. And so Annabella chose these a couple of pages. It's brief. I said in an email that I sent to my friends, you won't ever be bored. So I'm trying to, I got to keep up with that because I said that. But this will be quick. It's actually from later in the same chapter, I think. It's pretty much, well, it's the same section of, it is actually. It's just later in the same chapter. I just out of context, here it is. It's some pages later. Well, if I could sing, I would do this for you. There's a little quote of a song. "Oh, baby, my heart is full of love and desire for you. So come on down and do what you got to do." The swelling chorus of Thelma Houston's "Don't Leave Me This Way" is pulsing out of giant speakers ringing the dance floor of a steamy discotheque in Quebec City. I am hustling with Margaret, her blazing eyes and open-mouthed smiles spinning around my ears as I lead her in our most complex spins and twirls. The triple fake, the behind-the-neck switcheroo, the walking turn. We're on our senior trip, organized by Stan. 3 nights and 4 days in Canada. I have taken a hit of THC, but am feeling nothing yet. We leave the club, planning to check out another. Stan and Marlene, our adult chaperones, have given us a curfew, but have allowed us to explore the city unattended. I swallow another white pill. Maybe the first was beet. As we approach our destination, I'm starting to feel a little numb. I think I might pass out. "Hey, guys, give me a minute." I pause to gather myself, leaning against a building. I place my hand on the brick wall, and my hand feels like one giant block of cement scraping another. It sends a bizarre shiver through my gums. I think I have to go back to the hotel. By the time we get to our room, we are bunking in same-sex groups of 3 or 4, I can neither walk unassisted nor speak a single word. My friends lead me to the bed and summon Stan and Marlene. "What did he take?" I hear Marlene asking. "They're taking THC," Stan says knowingly. "How much?" Marlene presses. "I think he only took one," says a friend. "No, I took a second one, and I'm actually totally alert. I can hear you quite clearly. I just can't open my eyes or close my mouth or lift my head or stir my limbs at all. Please, just keep talking and stay with me. It's not entirely unpleasant, but it's not what I was hoping for either. How about you? How's your night going? You feeling anything?" I asked inside my head. Marlene, to the others, looking down at my corpse-like form. "He's fine. He's breathing normally. He'll sleep it off. No more pills. Let him rest. Give me a key. I'll check on him again. No, I scream from inside a prison of total paralysis. I don't want to be alone. Somebody stay. Don't leave me this way. With that, I flash back to my thrilling flight across the dance floor with Margaret. We are burning the boards with our moves, but I am also alone in a darkened hotel room, far from home, hoping I will not die. The two realities are equally vivid. The next morning, Stan and Marlene descend upon me and the other student government officials, my good friends Mike and Alan, and a kid named Ira, whom we never particularly connected with, but who'd won the presidency square and fair on a platform of students first. For a stern talking to, we'd already tried the patience of our mentors by smoking pot in the bus bathroom on the way to the airport, from the airport to our hotel. You're supposed to be setting an example for the others, Stan hisses. We thought we could trust you, Marlene laments, her genuine disappointment cutting to the quick. We were wrong. We vowed to change our ways, and did. No more pills. Just pot and liquor. But I could never drink much. That night, I downed 3 or 4 glasses of amaretto and threw up on the cobblestones outside a quiet little bar. The last time I remembered being that sick from drink was New Year's Eve a few years earlier, when I'd downed an entire bottle of sickly sweet sparkling wine, Jacobacci Lambrusco, on my way to a pre-party at Billy's house. His mother, draped in a flowing Pucci print lounging gown, noticed my particular shade of green and put her arm around my shoulder, an Eve Menthol 120 bouncing on her lip. What's the matter, honey? You don't look so good. Want a glass of water? Yes, I said, turning to her. Water might be... A river of vomit flowed up from my stomach, out of my mouth, and onto the neck and chest of my hostess. The traditional New Year's Eve dinner my mother had prepared, roast pork, lima beans, and escarole, the beans and greens representing coins and dollars, auguring wealth in the new year, the pork representing, well, pork, a dozen or more half-digested Christmas cookies, the quart of Jacobacci Lambrusco, it all rushed out in a hot, rancid stream onto the elegant garment Billy's mother had purchased just days earlier at Enza's, the high-end boutique on Allerton Avenue. Her face fell. She removed the cigarette from her mouth. That's all right, honey, she said flatly. Want to clean yourself up and go lay down? I'm going to change my dress. Thank you for choosing that. Annabella chose that. I might not have grossed you out that badly, but, you know, that was... Blame Annabella. So I'm not going to keep you too long, but I mean, if you want to... that chapter goes on. If you haven't had enough of that, it goes on. Oh, there's more. But anyway, I don't know. Yeah, you're signaling to me. Yeah, sure. You have questions? If anybody wants to say anything or ask anything or just leave if you want to leave. You're free to move around. No, but anything? No? You're going to shy now? Somebody I know maybe will break the ice? Annabella, have you a question? Maybe. Annabella asked me, do you find when you go around to people feel, and they've read the book, do they feel they can relate to it, you know, even if they're not Italian from the Bronx or, you know, one of the things that I am. And I think that they have. I mean, a lot of people, it's amazing people, even when I was doing the live shows, would say, you know, I grew up in wherever, upstate New York, and, you know, your father was my father, except, you know, the sort of farm version. And or I had a guy write me, he lived in Westchester County, and he said, your mother was my father. He just read the book and then wrote me an email through the website. And so people always, they you know, figure out who was who in their world. I hope that that's the case. I hope that people, a lot of the family dynamics are maybe familiar to you, or if you're lucky, they're not. And then it could just be like a visit to the zoo. for you. You know, Jerry Howard, my editor, the man who took a chance on me. This is him.
Hello, Carl.
Hi, Jerry.
So
my favorite.
Maybe you can tell people the thread that really runs through the whole book is your relationship with your father.
Yeah.
Who I always thought of as an early version of Rudy Giuliani.
Yeah.
Who perfected the type.
Yes.
So if you could talk about your father a little bit, because he's the other main character.
He is. He's the main. Yeah. He is, and in many ways, you know, the reason for writing the book. He died about 10 years ago, and my mother asked me when the book was just coming out, she said, would you have written this if your father was alive? And I said, no, I wouldn't have. But he was, I always have a hard time summing him up because in many ways, you know, the whole book is about him, but he was in some ways the kind of Italian-American father figure that you might recognize, you know, very hot-tempered, very opinionated, very controlling, all the things. My sisters here, two sisters are here tonight. They can vouch for this. In some ways, it's what you might expect. Very hardworking man, very selfless in his way, but all those things that you know, right? But then there were these whole other parts of him that were really just his own invention of himself that really I haven't seen in a lot of other places. He was very ambitious in his way. We had a pizza shop that he built and opened when I was about 6 years old in like 1964 under the L on White Plains Road in Pelham Parkway, which didn't work out so well, by the way, mainly because he was very fond of throwing customers out for various infractions of the rules, and there were a lot of rules. And there was a sign, like an 8-foot sign, you know, at the door that was like all these big red no's, no, and then different things, no running, no yelling, no shouting, no jumping, no pushing, no roller skates, no gravy carriages, no special orders, no extra, no slices at the table. Somewhere in the middle, it just said, this is not a basketball court. I mean, he was very more focused to me, I think, on those rules than anything else, so that as soon as somebody broke a rule, you know what, get out. Get out. You're running, you're pushing, you're jumping, you're whatever, one of these things, get out. So, you know, business was slow. And, but he also got, so, you know, that was already something that was working against us in terms of doing a lot of business. But then he would go off on these sidelines. So our local movie theater, the Globe Movie Theater, they started pushing it a little bit by showing M-rated movies. And then they got a little more daring, and they started showing X-rated movies. They went porno. And this is like 1960, you know, 5-ish, no, 6, 7, maybe 7, 67. And so their first offering was I Am Curious Yellow. You may not know that movie, but that was an early sort of artsy porn movie, right? Danish, I think. And so my father went nuts about this, and he organized a neighborhood campaign to shut them down. This very quickly grew into this huge crusade, and he formed a committee called the Committee to Control Obscenity by Constitutional Means. Oh, I still have the letterhead. 2259 White Plains Road is the address. Cappy's Pizza and Sandwich Shop was the national headquarters of the Committee to Control Obscenity by Constitutional Means. And he'd subscribe to the Congressional Record, and he would pour through it, and if he saw like anybody was sort of talking about his thing, he'd get in the car, like in his pizza whites, flour flying off of him, and fly up to Albany and, you know, lobby members of Congress, the state legislature, to get an anti-pornography amendment added to the U.S. Constitution. And I mean, he wasn't kidding around. This really became his main full-time job, was that. And that was one extracurricular thing. There were others. So he had a lot of complicated parts of him, my father. And I was the only son. And I was not probably the son that he imagined, you know, I would be. I don't think that I was what he imagined I would be. And so, you know, I was very compliant. I mean, I was rebellious, but I was quiet about my rebellion. I would just, like, sneak around with my rebellion. But to his face, I was very, very compliant. He said, do it. I did it. I mean, I was just trying to get good grades and not get killed, you know. But it was still like kind of a blood-soaked situation between us. And I like to think that it kind of got resolved toward the end of his life. There was a moment that we had, a sort of accidental moment that we had very shortly before he died, maybe a few weeks before he died. And I didn't know its meaning until after. I write about it in the book. So I'm glad we had that. And I'd like to think of him at peace now. He was a pretty embattled guy. You got to put these guys also in their context, you know. Came up during the Depression. His father died when he was 12. His mother knew very little English, had four kids. It's the Depression. She's living in, 116th Street and 3rd Avenue, and then they moved up to Arthur Avenue. It was very hard scrabble life, and he shipped off to war, and, try to put the guy in his context a little bit. Now that's in there, if you care. Yeah, well, her first response when I gave her the galley copy, I gave it to her, and she was very quiet about it, you know. And then in a couple of days, I was like, so, you know, any luck looking at that book, you know? And she said, I know where it is. That's a start. That's a start. And then she offered, it's under a pillow, so I don't have to see it. So I think she was terrified of this book. But she has gotten over that. She's actually been really beautiful about it. Look, this, I don't shy away from the dark stuff. And when I was doing some of these stories live, and I was trying to just keep it sort of, you know, the funny stuff. But, if you're going to do this, you got to really do it. So I do pummel into the darker stuff, and I don't think it's stuff that I don't even really talk about with my own family anymore. We all know it's there. Once in a while it comes up in some context or other, but you don't sit around going over that anymore. And here it all is, laid out in sequence, black and white. I mean, what parent really would like to see this? My mother did say to me once, she goes to a senior center, and she said, you know, before she read it, and she said, you know, I asked all my friends at the center, would you like your adult child to write a book about everything that ever happened behind closed doors in your family? Would you like that? And you know, they all said, no, I wouldn't. I wouldn't like that at all. So, you know, you gotta, yeah, I totally understand it, but I'm very happy to say that she did read it, finally. She did read it, and she's been so sweet and beautiful about it. She basically said to me, look, it was very hard for me to read, but you didn't leave me there. You found a way to pull the reader, even me, through it and onto the other side of it. And she saw the love, I think, that it was written with. I kept trying to reassure her that I would not have written this book if I couldn't write it as an act of love. If it was going to be some kind of indictment, I would do that privately. Not publicly. So even though I air our dirty laundry, I do it with love. They've been really amazing, my family, to go along with this with me. You know, who knows? If one of them wrote a book, you know, you're in your own moment of life. You don't necessarily want your sibling to go, oh, by the way, here it's all wrapped up between two covers, like our whole family drama. Here you go. Well, I didn't ask for that. Thanks. Anyway, so they've been enormously gracious. So I don't want to keep you too long. Maybe one more? What do you think? Somebody tell me, because I like doing this. I don't get out of my house a lot, so you have to cut me off. It's up to you.
What was harder for you, writing a book, getting into acting, or working at McDonald's for Curtis Sliwa?
I did work at McDonald's for Curtis Sliwa, you know. He was, and I'll tell you right now, and I don't know why, it's been so busy out here. By the way, so 1 week ago tonight, Barack Obama was elected. That was really exciting. And not only is it exciting in so many ways, but it also has calmed down the media landscape a little bit, and so that maybe we could get a little more interplay going on. So, because I've been dying for somebody to pluck this detail out, or for Curtis Sliwa to pluck this detail out and object to it. But as a teenager, I took a job on Ford Road at the McDonald's there in the closing shift, and my manager was Curtis Sliwa, who would go on to found the Guardian Angels, and now I think he's a right-wing radio talk show host or something. And but at the time, he was a McDonald's manager. And he performed a gay wedding ceremony back then, like in like 1976, you know, to my coworker and his boyfriend, this guy Ralph, the first really mincing queen I ever met. And it was the first time I heard the pronoun she being used to describe a male. I was very confused by Ralph, but he did tell me one day, you know, my boyfriend Vinny, she and me is going to get married. It's like, okay, I'm a little... And he said, yes, and Curtis, she's going to do the service. I said, really? Okay, then. All right, and so he invited us all, and so we went one Saturday afternoon, and they had the community room of their, South Bronx Project building all festooned, and they did it, you know, they did it up. Like, the mothers of the groom were all in their gowns, and there was like a, you know, like a flower girl and throwing petals, and Ralph and Vinny were in white-on-white tuxes, and Curtis Sliwa acted as the minister and performed the vows and handed them their rings. I want him to object to this because he's... Will someone tell him that this is in print? Because he's opposed to gay marriage. He performed a gay marriage, okay? 30-something years ago. Well, 20-something, no. It was 32 or more years ago. So he used to be much hipper. I didn't find it hard to work at McDonald's, as hard as that job was. No, the hardest thing was... writing this book, I guess, of the three options you gave me. I can think of harder things, but no, that was pretty hard. Writing it was pretty hard. So one more, what do you think? You tell me. Again, I'm a bad judge of this. I feel like these people are probably ready to leave. One more real quick one. Anybody? No? You going to leave me hanging? No? Karen? No? Nothing? No. Listen, let's wrap it up, and thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, visit npr.org/booktour.